good evening to all of you. We're going to try again in our study of the book of Daniel to make some headway, but I want to tell you a bit of a story. I think sometimes, and I think I've asked this question to you, how many of you have thought that the book of Daniel was somewhat difficult? Well, almost all of you. Well, I'm going to try to tell a story without getting bogged down, so we'll have a very loose overview of the book of Daniel so that we can take something home with us and know what the book of Daniel is about. I'm going to be noting some material from a particular commentator that I think boils some of this stuff down so that it's not quite as hard to grasp and not quite as much detail. And as we've been through somewhat of a detailed study, maybe this will be helpful. As we study Daniel, we're looking at a long journey that covers about 600 years of history that is yet to be lived. As we begin with Daniel in chapter 1, we see him beginning as just a boy, as a youth, a teenager perhaps, a Jewish captive brought from his homeland in Judea to a foreign land, many miles away, and never would he ever return home again. By God's providence, he was destined to be among the greatest prophets of God. And we begin this journey with Daniel as a student of Babylonian language, science, customs, politics, court manners, and he was guided under a number of Babylonian wise men. He graduated, if we may use that term in quotations, with honors and was awarded place in Nebuchadnezzar's court of advisors, but he was determined to maintain his Jewish faith and ordinances. Now that's basically what you read in chapter 1. In chapter 2, we learn that he served the king as interpreter of his dreams, interpreting them faithfully as God revealed the meanings unto him, though they might even be in detriment to the king. You remember that he told the king that his kingdom would pass away. And in this role, he revealed the future of world kingdoms and of the kingdom of God, which would be above all others, breaking and grinding the world powers, but the kingdom of God would fill the whole world. And the third chapter, we read of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, how that they shared the faith of Daniel, who was their mentor, and they defied the king's command to worship an image that he had erected on penalty of death if they should refuse. Their faith was revealed by God sending an angel to deliver them from the fiery furnace. Their heroic faith was rewarded by what we might call a eulogy from the king to the great God of heaven, whom they worshiped and they served. Their demonstration of faith has been a source of encouragement to all of us, has it not? And as we think further in chapter 3, in the midst of idols and people of the world of wickedness, these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, faithfully represented the God whom they worshiped. And then in chapter 4, Daniel continued to act as interpreter of dreams to the king when he dreamed a dream that foretold God's judgment upon him, except he humbled himself before the God of heaven. You remember that he would be made as a wild beast. The prophet added the role of counselor, to the king as he advised him what he would do or what to do to avert the humbling fulfillment of the dream. And further in chapter 4, the king wouldn't listen. He ignored the advice and suffered the consequences, spending what the Bible calls 7 times among the beasts of the field until he learned that God rules in the kingdoms of men and not the kings themselves, and that he sets up as rulers those who will serve his purpose. Now that elicited from the king his greatest praise of Jehovah, but at this point, he never acknowledged him as the only true and living God. We talked about that in a previous study. And then in chapter 5, with the passing of Nebuchadnezzar from the scene, Daniel served at the court of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, who perhaps was a son or grandson of the former great king. And while engaged in a drinking banquet, the king summons David to interpret handwriting that appeared on the wall. Summoned Daniel to interpret the handwriting that appeared on the wall, written by fingers of a man. Further in chapter 5, the message was the kingdom would pass to the Medes and the Persians, bringing the Babylonian kingdom and its rule to an end. That night, Belshazzar was slain, and Darius, the king of the Medes, assumed the rule for Cyrus, the great king who was now conquering the world. Now that's simple, isn't it? That's a review of the chapters, and I think rather simple. In the 6th chapter, with the fall of Babylon to the Persians, Darius not only retained Daniel among his administrators of government, but exalted him to a higher position, and that aroused the envy and jealousy of his fellow administrators who determined to destroy Daniel. Now, how did they determine to do that? Randy? All right, breaking a law that they made up. They had caused the king to make a decree that all the petitions to gods or men must pass his review and receive his endorsement. The king made and signed the decree, which Daniel ignored and continued praying 3 times each day, as he always had. Now, although the king tried diligently to revoke the decree, he failed and Daniel was cast into the den of lions. Why did he have trouble revoking the decree? All right, but what he could do is to hope that Daniel would be all right in the den of lions, and of course he was, even the next morning. Terry? Okay. God sent his angel to shut the mouth of the lions, and therefore he delivered Daniel from the lions' mouths. The lions, as it were, got their meal by the king casting his deceitful administrators into the den. An act of administrative justice, wouldn't you say? Daniel had stood firm in his faith from his youth to this point of old age. He would not fail him now, but would become an example of faith to all. Now, as important as that is, we need to be reminded that God did not fail Daniel. God's faithfulness to his true saints under all circumstances of life would likewise be remembered. Daniel prospered through the reigns of the kings of Babylon, Darius, and Cyrus, king of the Persians. Now, are there any questions about chapters 1 through chapter 6? Well, that's good. As we continue on with Daniel, we find that in the 7th chapter, some things begin to change. In the 7th chapter, our journey with Daniel through his career as interpreter of dreams and counselor to kings terminates at the end of chapter 6. Now we see a transition. He records his own dreams and visions and the revelations from both God and angels. Now that was different from what we have read. As we have studied in the first 6 chapters, he's been interpreting the dreams of others and the visions that others have had. In the 7th chapter, during the late Babylonian rule, in a dream, God revealed the coming of 4 beasts, which represented 4 great empires, to arise out of the upheavals in society. They would be judged and destroyed by Jehovah. At some point in the time of these kingdoms, one like the Son of Man would return to heaven and receive the kingdom of God. Now it's here that I want you to turn to the text of Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 7, we see the presentation of 4 beasts. The first was like a lion. The second, according to verse 5, was like unto a bear. And in verse 6, after this he said, I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard. And then at verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a 4th beast, terrible and powerful and strong exceedingly. And it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with its feet. And it was diverse from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Now let's pause there in the reading. Do we not see that Daniel in the 7th chapter is doing an overlay, much like we would use an overhead projector and just lay a sheet over it? We see that what Daniel is doing an overlay, something that parallels the empires of Daniel chapter 2. The 4th beast challenged the special interest of Daniel, which impressed its importance throughout the remainder of the book. And who would that fourth beast be? Rome. That's right. Now here's an overlay, if you please, of Daniel 2 and Daniel chapter 7. In Daniel chapter 2, the gold represented the kingdom of Babylon, the lion in Daniel chapter 7. The silver represented the Medo-Persian Empire in Daniel chapter 2. And in Daniel chapter 7, the bear represents the Medo-Persian Empire. And in Daniel chapter 2, in the image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw, the brass represented the Grecian or the Alexandrian Empire. And in the vision that Daniel sees in Daniel chapter 7, we see the leopard representing that. And then the iron representing Rome, and the iron teeth having the 10 horns representing Rome in Daniel the 7th chapter. Now, in Daniel chapter 2, Daniel tells us, and very significantly, a familiar passage to us, that in the days of these kings, the God of heaven's going to do something. He's going to set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, nor shall the sovereignty thereof be left to another people. But it shall break in pieces and consume all these and stand forever. Now in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel identifies, beginning at verse 13, or no, verse 9 is where I want to pick up the reading. I beheld till thrones were placed, and one that was ancient of days did sit. His raiment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, and the wheels thereof burning fire. A fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousands of thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. And judgment was set, and the books were opened. And I beheld at that time, because of the voice, the great words, or voice of the great words, which the horn spake, I beheld even till the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and it was given to be burned with fire. And as one of the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, yet their lives were prolonged for a season and a time. And I saw in the night visions, and behold, there came with the clouds of heaven one like unto a son of man. And he came even to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. And there was given him dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom that which shall not be destroyed. Daniel is describing the same thing in the 7th chapter that he had described in the second chapter, beginning at verse 44. In the days of these kings, God would do something. He would set up a kingdom. And in Daniel chapter 7, when one likened to the Son of Man would ascend to the Ancient of Days, there would be given unto him a kingdom. The nature of the kingdom in the 7th chapter is identical to the nature of the kingdom described in chapter 2. That is, it would break in pieces and stand, or consume all others and stand forever. Daniel says the same thing in his dream in chapter 7. Now, as this kingdom would stand forever, we find that there would be difficulties with existing kingdoms. As Daniel said, it would break in pieces and consume all others. Now, 2 years following the dream in Daniel chapter 7, we come to Daniel chapter 8. And 2 years following the dream of the four beasts, while yet in the Babylonian period, Daniel had a second dream. Now, it consisted of a he-goat and a ram, symbolizing the destruction of the Medo-Persian Empire by the Greek-Macedonian Empire, which occurred some 200 years later. Now let's be impressed with the time element here. We've mentioned that the purpose of Daniel's writing is to write history before it ever happened. How much history is recorded by Daniel before it occurred? How much of a time span? All right, about 400 and something years. And Daniel is writing how much before any of that begins to transpire? Another 200 years. So we've got about 600 years, basically, of history that Daniel is writing about before it ever comes to pass. And he gives us some pretty vivid details about some of that. And out of the breaking of the iron of the he-goat, that would be Alexander the Great, there would arise four lesser kingdoms. Now, out of the breaking of I said iron, the horn of the he-goat, Alexander the Great, there would arise four lesser kingdoms. What would cause Alexander the Great's kingdom to divide into four lesser kingdoms?
Alexander died.
Alexander died. That's right. Terry?
Now, Alexander died really without any heir.
All right. All right, and then what happened? Who was it that began to try to take his empire? The four generals, all right, that he had under him. The four generals began to try to take over the empire. Now, out of one of these, that is, one of these four generals, would emerge a king of fierce countenance, the 8th chapter tells us, that would oppose all that is holy and pertain to God. Now, this is where we are introduced to Antiochus or Antiochus Epiphanes. And we read of this character as one that is extremely evil. In response to Daniel's desire to know the meaning of the vision, Gabriel in verse 16 of Daniel chapter 8 is sent from heaven to make him understand the things that would come to pass later. Now, as Daniel is informed concerning these things in verse 26, he is told to shut thou up the vision, for it belongeth to many days to come. And I, Daniel, fainted and was sick certain days. Then I rose up and did the king's business, and I wondered at the vision, but none understood it. Daniel says that I was sick certain days. Now, Daniel not talking about having the flu. Why was Daniel sick? What is it that the significance of this vision reveals? Trouble for his people. And Daniel is troubled because at least he, though he may not have understood all the details of the vision, he did understand that it meant trouble for his people. And he lamented over those things as this evil king would begin to afflict the people of God. In Daniel chapter 8, in this dream, I may have gotten ahead of myself, dream of the ram and the goats, the goat and the ram, the two-horned ram, one was higher than the other. We've talked about that and noted the significance of it to indicate that the Persians were greater or mightier than the Medes in that picture, and that the he-goat, king of Greece, Alexander, his kingdom was divided among his generals, and we have them listed here on the board. The power of the little horn and the interpretation of the vision is seen to pertain to the time of the end. This fierce king would stand up. We've got him named. The desecration of the temple would take place by Antiochus. And as we come to the ninth chapter, we again are in the, or should not say again, but in the first year of the reign of Darius, by a study of the books, Daniel realized that according to Jeremiah, the captivity would terminate at the end of 70 years, which period was now coming to an end. Now you can picture that. In the story of Daniel, Daniel's been reading, underscore that, he's been reading from the prophecy of Jeremiah. And he's read that Jeremiah indicated that this period of captivity would last for 7 years. Now, Daniel's not a fool. He knows that he was one who was initially taken captive by the Babylonian Empire, and he can count. He knows that these days are near to coming to an end. And so Daniel is concerned about what's going to happen with him and with his people when this 70 years is completed. And Daniel prays one of the most fervent prayers found in the Old Testament. In fact, there are just a few prayers in the Old Testament that are like this one that Daniel prayed in Daniel chapter 9, which Randy sometime would make a fine sermon to talk about the prayers of the Old Testament. And note prayers like this one that Daniel prayed. What is it that Daniel prays for in the first part of the ninth chapter? The people. And in particular, what does he pray for on behalf of the people? Ken?
Forgiveness,
that's right. He wants God to be merciful to the people as he acknowledges and confesses the sins that are characteristic of the people. And so he wants the people to be forgiven. Furthermore, in Daniel chapter 9, the question is, what was to become of the nation, the city? What would happen to the temple? Now in response, Daniel's wanting to know this. So Daniel is going to be told what's going to happen to the nation, the city, the temple, and those things that pertain to importance among the people of God. Now in response, God showed him the vision of the 70 weeks. Now this portrayed in very few words, in fact, just a paragraph in our Bibles, very few words, the future history from Cyrus all the way to the Messiah, and some believe even to the destruction of the city of Jerusalem. Now that's a vast expanse of time, but we see that paraphrased in our chart, the verses 24 through verse 27 of Daniel chapter 9. Now, we can get bogged down in the language that's used in Daniel chapter 9. But in our review, we simply want to get the picture. What is it that's discussed in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through verse 27? It's a history that portrays the coming of the Messiah, the end of the Jewish entity as it begins to wind down. Now that's what Daniel is concerned about. That's what he said, I want to know, I want to understand that. And so he's told in this picture of the 70 weeks that are decreed upon the people, and then what would occur during that time. And I specifically want to call your attention to verse 24. Verse 24 of that text, where it says, 70 weeks are decreed upon thy people and upon thy holy city, number one, to finish transgression. Number two, to make an end of sins. Number three, to make reconciliation for iniquities. Number four, to bring in everlasting righteousness. And then number five, to seal up vision and prophecy. And number six, and to anoint the most holy. Now, Randy, therein again, you'd find a good sermon in just those 6 points. But what that indicates are things that will come to pass with the coming of the Messiah. When the Messiah comes, these things will be accomplished. Now, that's what's in Daniel chapter 9, verses 24 through verse 27. Any question or comment? You are just letting me rattle. Any question or comment? Maybe that's good. I don't know. Up to this point. Yes.
In verse 11, it says, yea, all Israel have transgressed their law even by departing, that they might not obey thy voice. Therefore the curse is poured upon us, and the oath that is written in the law of Moses. What is that?
Well, God had promised that if the people would obey Him, He would bless them. This is kind of what we've been studying about. As long as the people would obey Him, He would bless them. But if they did not obey Him, then He would curse them.
So it was foretold that they would even be doing this anyway, right?
Well, this period of captivity was foretold, that's right. And then the period of restoration was foretold in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1 through 10. That when a remnant would repent and do the things again according to the commandments of this book of statutes, ordinances, and law, then they would be restored to the land. So that's right. It was foretold. Now Moses is making mention of that in his prayer, that he understands that this is according to what God had foretold them. Okay? Any other comments? All right, David? Check your clock.
I'm not sure what time it is there. Is that when they say judgment and books were open in verse 10, is that what shall happen to the nations, or are they talking about the end of time?
No, he's not talking about the end of time here. If he was talking about the end of time here, it would be in connection then with the coming of the Son of Man to receive the kingdom. And we know that won't work, that won't fit with this context. He's talking about the coming of judgment upon these people. They would be judged out of the things written in the books. And we have language very similar to this, if not almost identical to it, in Revelation chapter 20, verses 11 through 15, that does in fact refer to the final judgment. Okay? All right? Yes, Randy?
Along the same lines of what he's talking about, drop it down to verse 13. I kept looking at the night vision, behold, in the clouds of heaven, like a son of man was coming and came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. Is that a vision of the ascension of Christ after his crucifixion?
I believe it is. Yes. That's when the kingdom was given to him, and that's when the purchase price was in reality made. Of course, his blood was shed upon the cross, but the book of Hebrews indicates that he presented his blood before the Father as an adequate sacrifice when he ascended. When he was exalted. And that's when he was exalted, at the right hand of God, seated there with the purchase price of his blood.
So chapter 2 says he'll set up the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
That's this exact...
Same scene.
Setting up the kingdom.
That's right. Same scene. When he would ascend to the Ancient of Days. Now, if we get that nailed down real good, Randy, and I think it's pretty easy to nail that down, we're equipped to talk to the premillennial teacher, because we have evidence then when he would receive the kingdom or be given a kingdom would be when he would ascend to the Ancient of Days. That is, in accordance with Acts 2, that was when he exalted and was seated at the right hand of God. Okay? Not when he descends, as they have it. Now, just a key note here, what will happen relative to the kingdom when he descends? All right, he will present it then to the Ancient of Days. That's exactly right. So that's good, Carolyn. All right, let's look now further in the 10th chapter. In the 10th chapter. I may get done early tonight, Richard. Introduce the book of Hebrews. In the 10th chapter, 2 years later, and Randy, I think you asked me a question sometime earlier about the visions. In fact, it might have been on this, the beginning of the 10th chapter, relative to the time element. 2 years later, after Daniel watched the departure of the remnant to Jerusalem and their homeland, there was revealed to Daniel the coming of a great warfare. Now, this warfare that is discussed, or begins to be discussed in chapter 10, become both physical and spiritual. In fact, the revealing and understanding were made to Daniel by the most majestic personage yet to appear to him. In fact, if you'll notice, beginning at verse 4 of chapter 10, it says, "And the 4th and 20th day of the first month, I was by the side of the great river, which is Hiddekel, and I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with pure gold of Uphaz, and his body also was like the beryl, and his face was as the appearance of lightning, and his eyes as flaming torches, and his arms and his feet likened to burnished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude." So we see the presentation of a glorious person, as we might refer to it, or a glorious man, that is revealing some of these things to Daniel. Now, the incidents of chapter 10 serve to introduce the elements of chapter 11 and chapter 12. I think it's significant that we see that somewhat as a whole and see chapter 10 to introduce those things. Now, this heavenly being was the chief speaker from that time until the end of the book. Now, we do see evidence of two other angels that appear with him, but this angel was the chief speaker from here till the end of the book. Now, chapter 11, Terry.
Chapter 11. Chapter 11 is prophecy or vision. And we can see fulfilled and recorded secular history from the time of the dividing Alexander's empire all the way through the 6 Syrian wars between the house of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and all the way into the period of the Maccabees.
All right, good, good. And
we see the a lot of the actions transactions of Antiochus Epiphanes and what his end was.
All right.
He died alone.
All right, he did indeed. And we find that he learned about the uprisings of Parthia and Armenia, which caused him great concern. And later he dies, as you said, alone, without any help. Now in the 12th chapter, this final chapter continues to deal with the vision of the time of the end, the fall of Jerusalem and the people of God. In the first portion of the verses, we see great tribulation described such as had never been before. We see the termination of that great tribulation, and then in verses 8 through verse 13, we see the triumph of the people of God. Now, the question, I think, that we need to wind up that portion of our study with is what would happen to Daniel? Now, Daniel is now an old man, and we see him having lived through the Babylonian period, the Medes and the Persians, and now we see him in the period of the Persian Empire and about to die. Now, he would sleep in death, according to verse 13, but at the end of these wonders that have been discussed and promised by the two or perhaps even more angels, he will stand in his lot with the faithful prophets and will be rewarded by seeing his prophecies and his visions fulfilled. Now, that's not hard, is it? That's just a very loose overview of the book of Daniel. And I hope that that provides you with something. I debated and debated and debated all day. I had some rather lengthy things that I wanted to talk with you about, in particular from chapter 7 through chapter 12. And the more I thought about that, I thought, now we're just going to get bogged down in details of review instead of actually reviewing what's in the book. And so what I wanted to do tonight is to just give a very brief overview of what's in the book of Daniel. Now, I'm going to ask you, do you find that helpful at all? I hope that that's something that we can take home with us and have a good idea of the things that Daniel is talking about. Now, Terry and I have talked at some length about what we want to do following the book of Daniel. I'm going to turn that off. Following the book of Daniel.
Can we get that in print?
You sure can. Okay, yes, you sure can. And you can have that in print. You can also go on the website and hear what we've had to say about it. Now, I want to give you the source of that material. I was reading and reading and reading lots of different material. But a book that I've recommended to you, it's very brief on the book of Daniel, is a commentary by Brother Homer Haley. He has some rather interesting things to say in his conclusion. There are some books that I think are valuable from the standpoint of their introduction. In fact, I've got one that I think is worth more than the price of the book just because of what it says in the introduction. Sometimes you find a very brief conclusion in a book that's just very helpful. So books can be helpful in that regard. But that's the source of the concluding remarks that I've noted for you for the most part. At the conclusion of our study. Now, we've talked a great deal in preparation for what we want to discuss with you as we move from the book of Daniel. And we want to talk about a New Testament book, the book of Hebrews. Some of you had expressed to me that you'd kind of like to study something a little easier to study than something like Ezekiel. I kind of wanted to study Ezekiel for a while. But there are many chapters in Ezekiel, and if we started down that road, we would be there for quite some time. I also wanted to study with you from the book of Jeremiah. But there and again, there are many chapters in the book of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah is not as complex, but Ezekiel is pretty complex. And both of those books might involve not only a great deal of time, but might prove to be somewhat difficult. So don't be surprised if you hear some sermons from time to time with books such as Ezekiel or Jeremiah as their basis. But as we study in our next portion of our Wednesday night class, let's turn our attention now to the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews. What I want to do with you tonight is again give you somewhat of an overview of what the book of Hebrews is about. The book of Hebrews is written to Hebrew Christians who have, simply by saying it that way, have left the practices of Judaism. Now, some of these are tempted because of persecution, or perhaps because of their kinsmen according to the flesh desiring to pull them back into the practices of Judaism. But many of these Hebrews who have become Christians are tempted to return to the practices of Judaism. Now, you know, and I know, the problems involved with that. The problem involved with that is they would be leaving the benefits of the shed blood of Christ. If they gave up those things and even tried to reinstate those Old Testament bloody animal sacrifices, they still would not have what they have in Christ. But moreover, you can't go back. Those animal sacrifices, once the blood of Christ had been shed, would be of no more value to them. You can't go back. And so the temptation to return to the practices of Judaism would simply be a stumbling block to them in many ways. So that's the essence of the book. I've often used the illustration, and perhaps even recently, that the book of Hebrews might be illustrated with a dog that has a big juicy bone in his mouth. And he comes to a pool of water and he looks into the water, and what does he see? He sees a dog with a big juicy bone in his mouth. And what then is he likely to do? Drop the bone that he has in his mouth to try to get the bone from the dog that he sees in the water. And in the process, he loses everything. That's what these Hebrews would do if they returned to the practices of the law. They would lose everything. Okay? And if they lost everything, then for them, the shed blood of Christ would serve no value. Now, in the first chapter, again, this is just going to be a very loose overview of the book of Hebrews. We'll come back in our next study, and I want to have some more prepared introductory remarks for you that you can see on the chart. But the text tells us in the first verse of the first chapter that God, having of old time spoken unto the fathers and the prophets by divers portions and in divers manners, hath at the end of these days spoken unto us in His Son. Let's pause right there. It's important to discuss the book of Hebrews from the standpoint of authority. If the Hebrew writer is going to appeal to these people not to give up what they have in Christ, then he's going to have to appeal to the source of authority by which what they have exists. Does that make sense? The authority is Jesus, the Son of God. His Son. He speaks to us through His Son. Now, in the first chapter, there is a comparison that takes place. What is the comparison? Johnny, go ahead. All right, Jesus to the old prophets, and a bulk of the chapter is spent comparing Jesus to the angels, showing that He's not said any of these things even about the angels. So as great as the angels were, they are not the ones through whom God speaks His message to us in these last days. Now that's the essence of the first chapter. In the second chapter, the first verse of the second chapter says, therefore, we ought to give the more earnest heed to the things that were heard, lest haply we drift away from them. And then he illustrates that. If the word spoken through angels proved steadfast, and every transgression and disobedience received a just recompense of reward, how shall we escape if we neglect so great a salvation, which having at the first been spoken through the Lord, was confirmed unto us by them that heard? The writer is saying, those things that you now have, why would you leave those and go back? Juan?
I don't really answer that question.
Now that's the question, and you had your hand up.
but one thing I want to know is that you keep saying, like, the author, like, who says to everybody?
I often say the Hebrew writer. Sometimes I might inadvertently say the Apostle Paul says this. Or I might even find some who would write and say that Barnabas said this. The fact is that in this epistle, the writer is not identified. So we don't know exactly who the writer is of this particular book. That's why I often refer to it as the Hebrew writer. Now, the language is very similar to that of the Apostle Paul. And I'm almost that close to saying the Apostle Paul wrote this book. But I can't say that because he's not identified as the writer of this book, nor is he identified in any other book as the writer of the book of Hebrews. For example, the Apostle Peter recognizes the authority of Paul as an authentic writer when he says that some considered the things or twisted or perverted the things of our beloved brother Paul, indicating that Peter, that's in 2 Peter chapter 3, indicating that that Paul was indeed an inspired writer, that he wrote other books of the Bible, and those things were being twisted or perverted. But no other writer identifies that Paul wrote this book. So we're kind of up in the air as well to who wrote the book. I don't know. But I know it's an inspired book because it is indeed recognized as an inspired book by those who followed. It is a book that's included in the canon of the New Testament. And so it is one that we recognize as authentic. Terry and then David. That's right. So it's accepted as a book of canon. David, Randy, and David, and Judy. Okay.
It was all the way back to the first century. Quite a few authority for people who were recognized back then accepted.
Very similar to Galatians and Romans. Very similar language you'll find in these books. So yes, the subject matter and the fact that it's included in canon text by the oldest of the manuscripts all help us to believe that not only is it an inspired book, but provide evidence that Paul is a very likely writer. Where did that go from David? Randy?
Yeah. The other question on the other end of that is,
to whom is it written?
Who's it written to?
Yeah.
And can we assume that's the church in Jerusalem or not?
Well, yeah, I think it would be all Jews. It might permeate Jerusalem, but I think it wouldn't be limited to Jerusalem. The problem would be addressed to all Jews.
What I mean is, where do we get the name Hebrews?
I'll have to discuss that with you later. Where the name of it came from, the fact that it is called that. I don't know that I'm prepared to discuss that with you tonight. Well, that's right, but you don't have that here. You deal with the subject matter, and the subject matter is addressed to Hebrew Christians. That's what the subject matter discusses. Now, we know, for example, that the book of Galatians is written to the churches of Galatia because it's so identified. We know that the book of Romans is written to the saints in Rome because it is so identified. But the subject matter that is contained in Romans and Galatians is basically the same subject matter that's addressed here. So could we talk about, if we did not know that the Roman letter, for example, was written to those saints in Rome, could we call it Hebrews? Well, the subject matter, or we could call it the law, or something similar to that. But that's just speculation. But we know those things about those books. We don't see that identified here, but you'd identify the book by the subject matter that's being discussed in it. Okay? David and then Judy.
You've already said it, but I'll just kind of put my two cents worth in, I guess. You mentioned about the Hebrews going backwards, Hebrew Christians, and when it starts out with God for sundry times, then after
well, yes, one of the main threads that runs through the book of Hebrews. I'd like to suggest to you that the theme, perhaps, of the book surrounds the word better. Better. Because the word better occurs 12 times in the book of Hebrews. And we'll discuss what all of those are as we get a little further on in our introductory material. But just to abbreviate some of them, you have a better law, you have a better covenant, you have better promises and better sacrifices. And right.
And that's the message of the book. Who would be the target audience? Well, the Jews.
The Jews.
I mean, that would be the target audience for that theme. So, I mean, hence the title of the book, you know, the letter to the Hebrews.
Right.
And it seems to logically follow.
Yes. All right. Any other comment? Judy? Okay. You're going to bow right out. All right, Peggy? I wasn't going to say a thing.
Anyway, I received my first Bible from my parents. It was a King James Bible, and I distinctly remember the title of the book being the Epistle of Paul the Apostle to the Hebrews. So I have to believe that at one time, Bible scholars were convinced enough, I guess, to print that.
I would go so far as to say most scholars believe that Paul is the writer, but it's simply speculation. We can't be certain that he's the writer because we don't have evidence to that effect. But like I said, we can come about that close to saying that he is the author,
but
can't be certain.
The newer Bibles that are more recently published.
Right.
The Apostle Paul out.
Yeah, and probably that's better because we don't know for sure. Yeah, we don't know for sure. And so, in the second chapter, Randy, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I just want to throw one more thing in. You said that there's no evidence to that. It's not that there isn't evidence, it's that his name's not it.
Well, there's no conclusive evidence to that.
Yeah, conclusive.
Yeah.
I mean, the main piece of evidence that I'm aware of is all the Apostle Paul's letters in, grace be with you.
Mm-hmm.
All of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this one does, too.
Yeah. Well, the writing style throughout the letter.
It's always in the last line. Yeah. It's always in the closing remarks. It's grace be with you.
Lots of evidence to that effect. The writing style is very similar to the Apostle Paul's. And, so, yes, there is evidence, but there's nothing conclusive that you can say, well, that says it. Paul wrote it. So you can't do that. But in the second chapter, we see addressed the danger of drifting. Now, in the third chapter, you see the importance of... Is that the first one? That's the second one. Well, where did the first one go? Okay. I didn't hear the first one. All right. We'll discuss Hebrews next time.